I'm Chris Mandel, director of the Sedgwick Institute. Welcome to this installment of the Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. Today, I'm talking to John Roten, Senior Vice President of Regulatory Compliance and Quality at Sedgwick. John has a wealth of knowledge gained from his roles at the California Self-Insurance Office and the Self-Insurance Security Fund, and Sedgwick's lucky to have him on our team. Welcome, John.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time for this. So, John, I always like to start with the personal. So if you don't mind sharing a little bit about your family and what you do in your spare time, let me know.
Sure. Well, simply put, I'm married and I'm enjoying life. My wife and I, we've been married about 10 years, and she has a grown son who lives in Hawaii, so that's a very good reason to go visit Hawaii a lot. And I have two grown kids from a prior marriage, a son and a daughter, and I'm very proud of the two of them and kind of the adults they've grown into being. And my daughter has three young kids of her own, so we're grandparents, which is very fun and also kind of a new experience. They're seven down to 2 years old, and it's kind of like raising your kids again, but they go home at the end of the night.
I understand. I've got a couple myself. I saw a joke the other day. I think it was George Burns or somebody that gave it years ago, and he said he's really appreciates tight-knit, close, dedicated families that live at least a state away.
Yes.
And that's where, you know, sometimes taking care of grandkids can be a challenging thing if it becomes too frequent. So hopefully you play golf if you make it to Hawaii with any regularity. You know, the reason I learned was because I used to run an insurance company in Bermuda, and I finally gave in. So do you play golf?
A little bit. I play at it, maybe.
Yeah, me too. I understand exactly what you mean. So let's turn to your career in the industry. If you don't mind, give me an overview of what your kind of key roles have been and kind of how your career got to where it is now.
Sure. Well, I'm going to go way, way back, but I'll be quick about it. Originally, I started my professional life as a deputy sheriff, and I did that for a couple of years and had an opportunity. My mom and dad were both business owners, small business owners, and so I guess I had an entrepreneurial spirit myself, and so after a few years of being with the sheriff's office, I was concerned of where that might take me over a lifetime with regards to the impacts of law enforcement. And so I had an opportunity to present itself to start a company, which I did, and founded a company and owned it for 18 years and grew it from a startup of just myself to about 1,200 employees. And while it wasn't in the insurance industry, as an employer of that many people, I had a lot of exposure from the user or consumer side to insurance, and especially workers' compensation. In 1999, kind of with the dot-com collapse, our company was one of the victims of that, along with hundreds of other large companies. So as a result, I started looking around for what to do next. And in 2000, I decided to go to work for the state of California. And my daughter was just starting junior high school at that point, and I wanted more time to kind of be around for her and then also my son, who was much younger at that point. So public employment seemed to kind of fill the bill in that it provided a 40-hour work week versus I hadn't realized how 7-day, 24-hour a day consuming having a 1,200-person company really was, but I was always, even when I was present, my mind was elsewhere. So I started with the state as a senior investigator, kind of returning to the law enforcement roots, and I started doing public corruption and ethics investigations, campaign finance, for about 5 years. And then from there I evolved and moved over to another agency and moved into doing undercover financial crimes investigations, kind of the state level versions of the Bernie Madoffs of the world, and that was fascinating work, the investigating the scams and kind of all the stuff people will do to one another and take advantage of, especially the elderly, which was one of the areas that we dealt with a lot. after about
5 years
there,
you have a background in accounting or finance that kind of helped you do that?
Well, I do from owning a business. Being an entrepreneur, I had a lot of accounting classes and stuff, and so but a lot of it really goes back to just asking questions and giving people the opportunity to take advantage of you when you're undercover, and there's no shortage of people out there that will prey on other people, unfortunately.
Wow. And, That's a big shift from being an entrepreneur to going into the public sector.
It is. I found it interesting the knowledge I had from owning and operating a business and that side of it to the come-ons and kind of the scams these folks would run. I understand very easily how a layperson could very easily be taken advantage of and kind of brought into this, and boy, this is the next best thing since, sliced bread.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all going to get rich, and unfortunately that, it was even a little more unbelievable to me a little bit, because it had a little bit of a reality test of a lot of the scams we ran across were things where people were selling, shares in gold mines and oil wells and things that it's like, really? I have trouble believing people buy this stuff, but they do. We had hundreds, actually thousands of victims that we were representing and investigating, trying to get their money back for.
So,
again, moving on from there, after that, I left and changed gears and went over to the Department of Industrial Relations for the California, and I was the assistant chief, appointed assistant chief for CalOSHA, which is the Workplace Safety and Health Organization, and did that for a couple of years, and then was tapped from there to become chief of the Office of Self-Insurance Plans to oversee and regulate self-insured workers' compensation in California.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of along those time frames, I also for those 15 years, I was an adjunct professor teaching entrepreneurship and risk management part-time at the community college level. And then I decided to retire from the state in end of 2015, and in 2016 I joined Sedgwick as the SVP of Regulatory Compliance and Quality, and it just kind of, everything kind of fit together well, and that's how I got.
So you weren't really looking to retire and just move on to your next thing, huh?
Exactly. Yeah. No. Yeah. I wasn't ready to retire, but it was kind of an interesting winding journey from where I started to where I am today.
Indeed. First thing that occurred to me when you started talking about your investigative background is how much your skills might be useful in Washington these days. Maybe you can help Trump drain the swamp.
I have many hobbies, but one of my hobbies is kind of watching the stuff going on and thinking, well, now if it were me, I would. That's all, armchair quarterbacking stuff. So.
Well, you got a lot of things to choose from, but what among those things might be your most significant accomplishment so far?
Well, you're right. I guess my first response to that would be raising bright, responsible, caring kids. I continue to be amazed at my son and daughter, and they're just great people. And so if I had to pick most significant accomplishment, that's probably the legacy that I probably will wind up leaving after I'm long gone, is hopefully the impacts that they will have in a positive way, in people they come in contact with. However, that's maybe a pad answer for any parent, but
depends.
Kind of another
if
area.
Your kids are in jail, maybe not.
True. But to give you a little more insight, maybe on other fronts, some of the other things that I consider significant accomplishments would be founding and growing a company from scratch, from concept to 1,200 people, and highly successful over 18 years. The company was twice ranked by Inc. magazine on their list of the 500 fastest growing companies in America. That's something that I take a lot of pride in.
That's awesome. What did you say the company was about? What was the product?
We started initially kind of from being a sheriff. We started initially providing robbery prevention services to a franchisee of McDonald's, what was our first client. But from there it grew into, we had a very large, we had provided uniformed security officers. We had a side company or division that provided armored car services like a Loomis or Brink service. We had a very large investigative unit that provided investigation services for Sabrosa, litigation support, workers' compensation, fraud. And then from there, it also evolved into providing staffing services, professional staffing services for accounting departments.
Wow. Pretty interesting. So you were kind of like a mini G4S, I suppose, at the time, focused on California, right?
Exactly, yes. That would be exactly the good analogy, other than we're much smaller than their $5 billion in revenue.
Indeed. Well, John, I know that we picked you up for a number of things, and not the least of which was helping us kind of navigate the regulatory world that, you know, we operate in and that is very significant to us. So where do you see that regulatory world going in the next 10 years, in our business in particular?
Well, that's a good question. I'll preface my answer with I don't have a crystal ball. 10 years in this environment right now, 10 years is a long time to look out in the future. And because right now we're at a period of incredible change. And that's why I say it's kind of hard to look that far in the future, because I'm not sure we even know the questions we need to be asking necessarily to really understand where the world will be in 10 years. I think a couple of areas, I think probably for the regulatory climate, there will be, I think technology is going to be an area that's, there's going to be a major role for regulatory agencies. And I think that's going to dramatically evolve maybe both in compliance reporting and also for accountability to consumers and stakeholders. The so many regulatory agencies, and I attend a lot of industry conferences and regulator roundtables, and at these, what I've heard consistently across the country is most of these departments are not getting properly funded by their legislatures, and therefore they don't have the dollars to invest in upgrading technology. So they're kind of lagging dramatically behind private sector industry, which is who they're regulating. And so you almost have an analogy I like to use. You almost have private sector companies, such as Sedgwick as an example. You have like a Formula One race car from a technology standpoint and capability standpoint that's ready to go. But what you have is you have a regulator functioning much like a real regulator on the engine that says, no, you can't go 200 miles an hour. We won't let you go faster than 55 miles an hour. And they're kind of, it's creating kind of an artificial dumbing down of evolution and technology. And I really see that as one of the areas that I think regulators are getting more on board with this, but I think that's going to be a friction point in the industry. There are more and more, as the regulators develop more and more technology capability, that's going to be an area that's going to really dramatically change things over the next 10 years.
Yeah. Well, we can certainly identify with the issue. I mean, even for companies that make a nice profit, you know, investing in keeping up with technology is a constant challenge.
And I think shifting from that, though, I would agree completely. But shifting from that, I think there's two other major challenges that we're going to be dealing with over the next 10 years. And I think that we're going to need to address them moving forward. One is, and maybe three, but one is disruptors. There are a lot of disruptors coming into the into the field, the industry, and we're seeing this throughout our lives. Everything from autonomous vehicles to, in kind of all areas of life, the internet has changed how we communicate, how we work, and so I think it's going to be a challenge for a challenge in the regulatory climate, at least, of how do we effectively keep up with and regulate new industries and offerings that didn't exist 6 months ago? Because typically regulators don't move that quickly and don't have the capacity to develop regulations and all that. And so, you have this friction between the speed of disruption and new industries evolving and a slower regulatory process.
The good news is I've seen some evidence that at least the NAIC is interested in that issue enough to actually attend industry forums as like those sponsored by Google and ITL that I'm aware of, where they really want to understand the direction that some of these private companies and public companies are taking things so that they can do their job better.
Yeah. And I would probably say that maybe the other two items that I was alluding to that may be issues on the regulatory climate, one will be changes and challenges from demographic changes in society, aging society, but also millennials coming up. All of these factors are going to change the products and the needs and demands of the marketplace and the industry, and I think that's going to have a direct impact on how things are regulated and how they evolve. And then the final item would be kind of jurisdictional control, where it should appropriately reside. We're seeing this playing out actually in today in the news. Trying to figure out, should it be, local state control? Should it be federal regulation? And we have these two systems, but we also have dramatic influence and issues going on with international markets. And so those are kind of challenges that I think those areas are what are going to drive and be the key things for the regulatory climate going forward for the next decade.
Well, that's a great segue to something I wanted your opinion on, and that is, how you see the Trump administration affecting regulation and the regulatory climate in the work comp and safety world.
Yeah, boy, that's a great question. My own opinion, let me preface it with that. My opinion is, I think it's probably too early to really tell. I think the administration is, one thing they've signaled is less regulation from the federal level is what they're advocating and signaling. But how that plays out, I'm not really sure. And I don't think that the current administration has found their footing yet. And they're dealing with kind of the change and evolution of coming into office and trying to get grounded and figure out how things work and how stuff happens. And so I don't think they've got their footing yet. But I think that with regards to workers' compensation and safety, I think those items and agendas are probably a lot further down their down the to-do or task list maybe than some of the more pressing issues that they're dealing with and that are evolving. And they're also President Trump is also trying to fulfill a lot of his campaign promises at the same time. And so, I think workers' comp and safety, I don't think that's going to pop up here in the next immediate future. It may be much later in the first four-year cycle.
Maybe to narrow this a bit, do you have any thoughts about the presumed presumed Secretary of Labor, Costas, I think is his name, and where he'll take DOL?
I really don't. Obviously, much of the current administration is going to be very, very polar opposite from the previous administration. And so I think you could probably take that kind of an approach towards, if you're looking at workers' compensation or safety or any area, you could look at the way we did it the past 8 years, and it's probably safe to assume we're going to be trying to do it exactly the opposite the next 8 years or next 4 years, depending on how this works out. So,
well, I have an interesting anecdote I'll share with you to fill in that question. It doesn't necessarily relate to Costas because, as far as I know, he's not confirmed yet. But, the Association of Responsible Alternatives for Work Comp, on whose board I sit on behalf of Sedgwick, has been attempting to, I guess you'd say, ensure that the Texas non-subscription system is not undermined by the Department of Labor's interest in some rule changes. And, when that looked imminent, and after some lobbying activity, we at least got a bit of a stay that suggests that at least in the case of the regional office, and in this case we're talking the Dallas regional office, they decided not to pursue their aggressive position that they'd been trying to impose on Texas non-subscribers, presumably in favor of waiting to see what the administration signals about that and where it sits on the priority list, to your earlier point. So we'll see.
Yeah, It should be interesting. The I know that Ryan Brennan, who's the insurance commissioner for Texas, is very insightful and very forward-thinking, and I know Texas has come out with a lot of programs and policies that are kind of considered to be model policies within the country that a lot of other states are looking to and looking towards trying to replicate that. A challenge sometimes that happens when you do that, though, is that while Texas is a large state, you know, much like California, New York, and when you have a smaller state or a much smaller state try to replicate or implement those similar policies, they don't always fit, and the outcomes aren't the same because you have a different environment, different industries, different people involved. And the citizens are different, and the legislature is different. And usually when they try to replicate this, they don't take the system exactly as it is. They take the concept and then modify and tweak it a lot. And so you really don't have an apples and apples, system occurring. You have, you know, an apple in Texas, and you have something else that, you know, some other state comes up with. And minor tweaks can have dramatically different outcomes or impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've been an astute observer of what's been going on in the industry of work comp, if we want to call it an industry, for the time you've been with us, and I'm sure before that. What's your perspective on the kind of current state of the work comp industry?
It's continuing to evolve. I mean, you would think 100 years into this, you'd think that it would be a mature industry. And in some respects, it is. But in other respects, we're constantly rethinking how can we provide or deliver benefits and services better. And there does seem to be more awareness on the part of regulators, even focused on outcomes. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's an interesting but also kind of a challenging time and a time of dramatic change to how things are happening. There's a lot of opportunities, I believe, that exist for everybody within workers' comp to provide to achieve better outcomes. Obviously, is not news to anybody, but the opioid crisis, an issue that we're dealing with nationally, the epidemic is something that we've got to address, we've got to get a handle on, and we've got to resolve. And and I think it's those types of challenges that are going to impact kind of how the industry continues to operate but also evolve.
Agree. We're actually at the Institute doing some work with J.D. Power on the opioid abuse question, and in particular how TPAs might, you know, contribute to the solution, because lots of people have their fingers in that pie. But do you think there's any evidence to suggest that, as some have said and alleged, that the grand bargain has been significantly jeopardized by reforms of the last 5 or 10 years?
It's an interesting question. I mean, obviously, there's IAIDC has been instrumental in a national conversation over the past year and 2016 on that very topic, taking a look at it. And I wouldn't say that the grand bargain is outdated or it doesn't work or anything like that necessarily, but I kind of do have a sense, and this goes back to, I think we're in a period of change, a time of change, dramatic change. Internet communication technology, some pressures and issues on what are we, just aging of society and growth, which is causing impacts in the workplace with regards to comorbidities and all of injuries. But then I think you also have, with regards to the grand bargain, I think what we're going to have is, I think I'm kind of tied to the word evolution. I think we're evolving. And I don't know that it's outdated or it's going to be, you know, discarded or it's become antiquated, but I think what the future looks like is going to have to essentially evolve. and it's going to involve change to accomplish that. But I don't think we want to. I hate to use this cliche, but I don't think we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater when it comes to workers' compensation. I think we have a sound, quality, well-functioning system. I think there's ways that we can improve it and achieve better outcomes, and continue to always with quality. You're always looking for how can you do things better, but also how can you improve outcomes incrementally, and always improve over time. I know that I think one thing that really is a change currently, and it's something I know at Sedgwick we're very focused on, but I mean everyone's aware of this, is that taking care of the injured worker, and we have a caring counts philosophy, and that's something that maybe was less addressed in the early days of the grand bargain, as an example. It was really more transactional, and I think that going forward, I think really caring for the person, talking, communicating more clearly, and really listening to what their needs are, and providing that kind of that caring philosophy, I think that that's going to have a dramatic impact on, one, how, from a system standpoint, how it evolves, because that's something that's hard to regulate. But then secondly, the other piece of it is, I think that's going to probably has the benefit or the opportunity to really drive the greatest improvement in outcomes and improvement in quality over time. And it's kind of the evolution I'm referring to.
Well, that sounds like good advice to our own 15,000 claim professionals, many of whom deal with worker comp in their daily role. So I'm sure they're all taking that to heart these days. Well, John, I think those are the key questions I had for you. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, I really appreciate the time and the ability to be here today with you. And probably if I were to wrap it up, my final comment or advice would be, as we look to the future, stay tuned. Should be an interesting and wild ride as we move forward here.
Indeed. Well, thanks, John, for your time and your insight. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Chris.
To my listeners, you can find Bill Zachary and Dr. Richard Victor's and my speaking and writing schedules, as well as other resources, at www.sedgwickinstitute.com. Please consider joining the Institute's LinkedIn group titled Sedgwick Institute, where we dialogue daily on issues of importance to stakeholders in the risk and insurance world. Till next month, when we'll have our next installment of SI Live, where I'll interview Gert Kruwagen, the Director of Risk Management for TSOGO, Sun Hotel and Resort Company out of South Africa. In the meantime, I urge you to use your expertise and influence to make a difference whenever and wherever you can to make this industry better.